Hello and welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm going to be your host here, Dana Osman, here with my friend Chavruta and Gordon. Our daf today, Masachet Bava Metzia, daf Dalet, page 4. So we're in the middle of a rather lengthy discussion that started on yesterday's daf about Rabbi Chia, who has this Kal V'Chomer that he basically developed, which is the idea that a stringent law, right, we have this more stringent or more machmir law that a defendant must deny under oath an unsupported claim. If there was a, remember the case was that like if someone says you owe me a mana, and then the other person comes and says no, I owe you 50 zoos. I only borrowed 50 zoos from you. So he agrees that he owes him something, but half of that, a mana is worth 100 zoos. Half of the loan, he basically says doesn't exist at all. So what Rabbi Chia says is that the defendant under oath, this litigant under, you know, has to deny under oath, he has to take a shvua that second half doesn't exist, right? That other 50 zoos doesn't exist and he'd have to pay the 50 zoos. So he uses a Kal V'Chomer to prove that a law that you see in a lenient case also has to be implied in a stringent case. Okay, so this is what they're sort of in the middle of talking about, all right? But a Kal V'Chomer cannot prove that a law found in a lenient case can be applied to a more stringent case, right? He's basically saying his Kal V'Chomer is that if you have a stringent case, a case that's more machmir, you can obviously apply it to a case that's more mekel. But the reverse would not be true. So this is sort of what they're in the middle of discussing back and forth here. And Rav Papa came to sort of understand how does Rabbi Chia actually, you know, derive his Kal V'Chomer. And he says here, Ella Amar Rav Papa. So Rav Papa says, this is after some discussion back and forth of how he can derive it. Ate migigush fua de'ed achad. Rabbi Chia's, you know, is derived. This Kal V'Chomer is derived from the case of a devolved oath that was generated by the testimony of a single witness. So what this is talking about is that if you have the testimony of a single witness, remember, normally for witnesses, we need two witnesses, but here's where you have one witness, and that really can't obligate you to have to pay any money, right? But the testimony of a single witness can create an obligation to take an oath denying that unsubstantiated claim. So in other words, if one witness came and said, no, you really do owe, you know, like, in other words, could comment on that situation, right? You do owe it. And the guy says, no, I don't owe it. He would have to take an oath. Okay. And so that one witness can basically obligate somebody to take an oath. Okay. So then that would mean that certainly the testimony of witnesses, right? Two witnesses who can obligate the payment of money, they can create an obligation to take an oath denying this unsubstantiated claim. So the Gemara doesn't like this, and it says, "Mali gilgush shvuah de'ed achad, shekein shvuah goreret shvuah." Right? What do you prove from the devolved oath of a solitary witness, where one oath draws another oath? Tomar be'idim de'mamon kamachayev. Can you say the same about two witnesses who actually obligated the payment of money and not an oath? In other words, the Gemara is saying you can't ever compare one witness to two witnesses. Because as soon as you have two witnesses who say you owe money, the only way you can get out of paying is if you take a shvuah, right? The only way you can get out of paying is taking an oath. This case with having one witness is still like a totally separate case because you never were really obligated to pay the actual money itself. So the Gemara basically at this point, right, has to agree with what Rav Papa says, that the way Rabbi Chia derived this law is from this case of the devolved oath of a single witness, right? The Gemara basically says, like, okay, this doesn't actually make sense. So now they're going to go back to the first proof that they had that Rabbi Chia gets his Kal V'Chomer from the basic oath that comes from a voluntary witness, right? And so let me go through a little bit more what happens here. And because we've been going through a bunch of objections of essentially how to understand Rabbi Chia's Kal V'Chomer, which we commented yesterday was very interesting that this wasn't sort of like a standard Kal V'Chomer that everybody understood. But here, right, the solitary witness can generate an oath regarding what he testifies, whereas what Rabbi Chiya wants to say is that there is a greater ability of witnesses to generate an oath regarding with what they did not testify, okay? So the Gemara goes on to say, Piyav Yochiyach, okay? Let the oath be generated by an admission of his own mouth, right? So that, in other words, the reason why somebody would have to take an oath is because the litigant said something that sort of like obligates him, so that the portion of the claim that the oath involves isn't essential. In other words, he has some admission that he owes some money. And because there's that admission, right, an oath obligation is essentially created, right, with the part of the claim that he didn't admit to. Okay, that's basically what he admitted something. So this creates that now he needs to take an oath for the part of the claim that he did not admit to. Now, the Gemara says, Malafiv Shachain Eino Behashgacha, right? What can you prove from the admission of his own mouth, which is not subject to a contradiction by witnesses? In other words, if you want to say that the oath only comes about because he himself said it, he himself said a claim, we're going to say witnesses have nothing to do with this. But then who comes to contradiction? The whole idea of having a witness is that the witness contradicts what the litigant actually says, right? But if you have no witnesses, you don't have anyone to contradict what he said. So what the Gemara says here is, Eid achad yochiyach sheyeshnu b'hashkacha u'michavo shvua. So let the case of the solitary witness demonstrate, right, that it's not the admission which is what creates the oath, right? For the testimony of a solitary witness is subject to contradiction by other witnesses, yet it obligates the defendant to take an oath. In other words, what's unique about the case of the single witnesses is that that could also be contradicted by other witnesses. And at the same time, it will obligate the litigant to actually have to take an oath to deny what the single witness says. Okay? And so the Gemara then goes on and says, Ma le'ed achad, shekein alma she'me'id hu nishba, right? How can you prove anything from the case of a solitary witness where the defendant has to swear that which the solitary witness testified about? Tomar be'idim she'alma she'kafar hu nishba. Can you say the same of two witnesses, right? In that case, you want to prove that the defendant must also swear regarding that which was denied. Okay? So that, in other words, the issue here is that when you have this solitary witness, right? Essentially, you have this witness who comes, who gives some testimony, you know, against what the litigant claims, right? The litigant claims, I only owe half the money. And then a solitary witness comes and says, no, he actually owes half the money. But this denial by the defendant isn't enough, right? And therefore, the only way you can deny something that a witness says is through a shvua, is through an oath, okay? But in a case where you have witnesses who can verify half the claim, right, the second half of the claim is not verified at all. And that's really the question here of what we're trying to figure out. So in that case, why would you still need to have a shvua? And that's the case where Rabbi Chiya has to have this kal v'chomer for. So what they don't sort of like is, and what they're sort of going back and forth on here, is that, you know, you can't really prove anything from this case of the solitary witness where the defendant has to swear regarding the solitary witness. How can you apply that or say it's equal to the same case of two witnesses, right, where you also have to give a shvua? Because remember, Rabbi Chiya is trying to say we go from machmir to mekel, right? We can say if a case is more machmir, then it also has to apply to a more mekel case. The machmir case is the case of the two witnesses. But they're saying here, this more mekel case of the single witness, it sort of just doesn't make sense that you're comparing the two at all. So it goes on to say, piv yochiyach, right? So let's say the oath has to happen because of the admission of his own mouth, right? That he knows that some part of the claim, right, he actually owes, right? But the oath isn't like actually on that part of the claim. V'chazar hadin, but the argument would repeat itself. In other words, you could sort of just keep going through the same cycle of saying that a personal admission doesn't have any type of, there's no way to contradict it, right? There's no witnesses. And so we basically say that we can't learn Rabbi Chiya's law either from a personal admission or from the case of a solitary witness. So again, they're trying to figure out what's the case. Where are we learning this from with Rabbi Chiya? So then they go on to say, So they finally basically say the nature of this case is not like the nature of that case, and the nature of that case is not like this case. In other words, the case of just personal admission, where there's no witnesses, in other words, there's nobody to contradict, is different from the case of a solitary witness, where you're basically saying there's not enough witnesses to accept or claim what the witnesses are true, but this solitary witness, the single witness, is going to obligate a shvua about what he said. In other words, that's what they're trying to say here. Hatsara shavesha behen she'al yedei ta'ana ukfira heim ba'im benishba, right? So their common characteristic, though, is that a result of a supported claim and denial that the litigants came from the court, the defendant has to swear. So in both of those cases, right, there's things that are too different about those cases, the personal admission versus the single witness. But in both of those cases, the point is that there's a claim and there's a denial, and it's enough to have to make the litigant swear. Afaniya v'edim she'al yedei ta'ana ukfira heim ba'in nishba. So too, if I present the case of witnesses, meaning there's two witnesses, and then the litigants come and before the court and they basically say there's a claim and a denial, right? Then I say that the defendant actually has to swear. In other words, the oath obligated by a personal admission of the part of the claim is, it's not related to the fact that there's nobody there to contradict the personal admission, right? Since you also, you know, if you have a solitary witness who can also be contradicted, you also have to take a shvua, okay? So it's that's not what it has nothing to do with whether or not you find a witness or don't find a witness with the issue of personal admission, right? There's no contradiction here, right? And the oath can't be obligated by a solitary witness, right? Only because the witness is only being a witness about one part of the claim, but the part of the shvua he needs to take is the part that the witness didn't necessarily talk about, and that's not where you would normally take you're not really taking the shvu on the part of the witness. So so essentially, right, the oaths are basically imposed on them, okay, because the defendant is denying a part of the claim, right, which is also supported at the same time. In other words, in this particular case, what it is that part of the claim the litigant says is true, and then part of the claim is also denied either by personal admission, right, by saying, like, I don't owe this money, or because a witness comes who says, you owe this money, but you didn't owe that money, okay? And so that's sort of like the common characteristic between these cases. I'm going to stop reading here because I read for long, and this section even goes on a little bit longer. They're still going to explore Rabbi Chiya's opinion of this Kal Vachomer. But in other words, I think what they're trying to do in a very, very detailed way is, you know, basically understand when you have this case where, like, one person says you owe me money and another person says I only owe you part of the money, there becomes sort of three different scenarios of how this could be played out. If there's two witnesses, then obviously if the litigant wants to say, I don't really owe you that money, he's going to have to take a shvua. But then the question becomes, if no witnesses step forward and there's just this personal admission of, like, yes, I owed you half the money, or a single witness comes and says, you know what, you actually owed all of the money, right? Can we say those cases are similar enough, or do we say those cases are very different? And what the Gemara essentially concludes is, the similarity, which is what's important to us to basically invoke a shvua, meaning saying the litigant has to take a shvua, is simply that part of it, part of whatever, you know, the cases, whatever the you know, the lender says was owed, the litigant, the borrower comes and says, yeah, part of the claim is true and part of the claim isn't true. There's a claim and there's also a denial. And so that's why you're going to have to take a shvua on both of those cases. But it's not necessarily because you're going to learn one from the other. So I'm not getting into like how they're going to resolve this whole thing with the Kal v'chomer, but I think it's just interesting to see the different ways, sort of the different pathways a case can take in court, either with the two witnesses, either with the single witness, or either by personal admission. And I think it's a key point because often when we talk about Jewish law and we say like, oh, you have to have two witnesses. Yes, you have to have two witnesses, but I think we also see like the court still will deal with cases even if there aren't two witnesses. And that's kind of like where the shvua has to come in. Even if there aren't two witnesses, it's not like you just get to walk away scot-free. The litigant still is going to have to deal with it and often may have to take a shvua because it's going to be very different than the two witness case. The idea of the two witness case, it's sort of like the proof is there overwhelming. So for you to take a shvua would really be a big deal. With the case of a personal admission or a solitary witness, it's almost like I think that's more often where you would take the shvua because there isn't really any other way to prove the case.
I think also, you know, I've mentioned a couple of times that I think a good portion of this issue, of the whole thing that we've seen so far in Bav Metzia, is about getting to the truth. And part of the issue is what happens when you can't really get to the truth because you have different people claiming different things. Let's assume for the case of the discussion that nobody is being false, right? It's not that somebody is lying. It's that each holds their own experience or their own perspective to be the true version of events. And so there have to be laws in place that will accommodate that to say, okay, under these circumstances, when we can't determine what the facts on the ground are because it's one person's word against another's, well, then that's when we have the need for, you know, sometimes there's testimony, sometimes you have to take a shvua, an oath, to make sure that, you know, that you're not lying, that nobody's lying in this case. And we end up with a certain amount of, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, like the protocols within a court to make sure that you can have a practical outcome, even when you don't really know exactly what happened.
So I actually really like how you said that, because I think, in other words, you're starting with a baseline of, it's not that the assumption is that someone is purposefully lying and trying to get away with something, like either that the witnesses are lying about the person or the person is trying to say like, no, I only owe half of it because they only want to pay half of it. You're saying it's more of a premise of like something may really not have been, somebody is not remembering something correctly or like the, you know, the, but it's not on purpose. It's not like to try and get away with something or to steal. And so the shvua sort of comes in here to be like, look, are you really going to commit to your version of the truth?
Right, exactly. So I'm going to pick up on this thread, this idea that, you know, each person has their own claim in court. I'm sorry. Towards, I don't know, it's still at the beginning, it's still on Amud Aleph, but it's heading towards Amud Bet. We have a discussion here. It says, Ha-hacha kivanda tafis, tafis. Right, it's referring back to the Mishnah where you each have one person taking half of the garment. Right, that was the beginning of the case. Shnayim ochazim b'talit, two people grab the garment that was, you know, nobody's until they pick it up. So then the question is, who got there first? So the Gemara explains, Anan sahadi demay detafis heilechu v'katani yishava. So we say straight up, right, that the person who grabs it, like that's the one who has takes possession of it. As long as, you know, that only works if the other person will then say, here, it's yours, you know, you take it. And then he has to take an oath, right? The idea being that they can both, again, establish their own position. So Rav Sheshet, the Gemara here, is going to address this position of Rav Sheshet, where Rav Sheshet Amar, Heilach, Heilach Patur. When somebody says, here you go, right, this is yours, that person is exempt from taking an oath. Because he went so far as to say, here, you take it, you know, and he still might deny the whole rest of the claim, but it doesn't matter because he's already taken that stance. So the Gemara explains, my Tama, why really is he exempt? Kevanda amarle Hani zuze de kamode bagavaihu kamanda nakit luhumalva dami baena chamishim halo modi hilkach leka hudat mixat ataana. So what happens is, you know, he said, here you go, right? This is yours. And so what that means is, whatever else he might have admitted to owing, right? It says, and I want to explain that there's a parallel case here, not just the case of the Mishnah, right? That there's a question of what happens when somebody says, you know, I don't owe this, or you didn't lend it to me, or I've already paid you back, right? Where there's some claim. And so when somebody says, like, here you go, I'm giving you part of what you've laid claim to, whether it's ochazim batalit or, you know, the two grabbing the garment or any other kind of claim, then when someone says, like, I accept this, I've given you that. So then we say, you know, let's say, for example, or the example that's brought here is he admits, he agrees to those dinarim that he owed. And then he says, but it says if the lender already had them back, and so that he doesn't have to say anything further about, let's say, a greater amount of the loan. And that's the case that's being addressed here, because he never said that he owed them to begin with. Let me take a step back and try to explain the case again a little further. These dapim, I think it's pretty clear. You know, they're very rich, but also very complicated in terms of all of the details of the potential cases. So somebody says, you owe me money. And the, you know, person A says, you owe me 150 dinar. And the guy says, here's your 100 dinar. And he never says, oh, I agreed to 150 dinar. He just says, take your money, and that's what I'm agreeing to. So the question then is, you know, he didn't ever acknowledge that he owed the other 50. And so then it says, leka hoda'at miksat hatana. He never admitted to that part of the claim. So, and in that case, that's where Rav Sheshet had said, you know, he's exempt from having to take the oath about that because he's already freely given the other portion. The Gemara says, Rav Sheshet kashya manin, but according to that opinion of Rav Sheshet, it seems that the mission itself is going to be tricky. Why? Because Rav Sheshet could have said, you know, the moment that Mishnah talks about an oath, the Mishnah from the first daf of Matzia, well, that's a rabbinic oath. And that's specifically for this case. So it's not necessarily about other kinds of partial admissions, let's say. And that's exactly the question. So now the question is, what about Rav Chia? So your Danny, you've already talked a bit about Rav Chia. Ve'idach, when you talk about the other guy here being Rabbi Chia, so again, he's also going to agree that we're talking about an oath that is a rabbinic decree, that the person in this circumstance would have to take that oath. However, but if you say that by the Oraita law, by Torah law, the moment you say, here you go, I'm paying you back this amount, that you have a Torah obligation to take that oath, well, then that explains why the sages would apply an oath the way it was described in the Mishnah. Even though it's a rabbinic oath, it kind of mirrors the other case of a Torah oath. But if you think that from the Torah level, the person who says, here you go, doesn't have to take an oath from a Torah level either. So then why are you having an oath in this case at all? That's the first question that, you know, that the sages want to ask here, that the Gemara asks here. And the Gemara answers with a question objecting to Rabbi Chia, namely, Meitveh. And here's a whole case. And I don't want to jump in, I don't want to delve too much into the whole case, except for basically, you know, somebody says, I lent you five dinar. And the person who borrowed it says, no, you only let me three. And now what happens? So the person who says you let me three is admitting to part of the claim, right? It's called modeh b'miksat. He admits modeh b'miksat to a partial, the same thing that he's being accused of, or that he's being told he needs to acknowledge and pay back, he admits to part of it. And that's where you would have to take an oath to say, no, I'm not messing with you. I'm not trying to get out of it. I truly believe, as you said, Yordana, before, I truly believe that this is my version. I paid you back. You only let me three to begin with, not five. So then Rabbi Kiva says, well, let's pay attention to the wording here. Eino ela kameshiv aveda upator. If you're talking about somebody who says you owe him, we're talking about an extra two dinar that he owes. He says he owes three. He doesn't owe five. So then isn't that, according to Rabbi Kiva, aren't we talking about the equivalent of returning a lost object, in which case he would be exempt from taking an oath, as opposed to the discussion about a loan and this contradiction of what has been borrowed. So the overlap between the potential cases, when is a loan, you know, with a partial admission, like returning an object, and where somebody's going to say, you owe this or you don't owe this, it's really different, apparently, right? Certainly according to Rabbi Kiva, as compared to a case where somebody, excuse me, is acknowledging part of a formal loan and then also has to deal with the oath. I want to jump ahead, and I think with this we'll close. I want to jump ahead to towards the end of the da, where we have Mar Zutra Barav Nachman, Raider of Nachman, who actually has a question, an objection against the opinion of Rav Sheshet that we already talked about. It's like this. Ta'anu kelim v'karkaot. Somebody says that you, like person A says that person B owes land and also kelim, vessels, right? Meaning matalim, movable property. And he borrowed apparently both the land and the property, and the movable property. Hodeh b'kelim v'kafar b'karkaot. And the guy, the person B says, yes, I borrowed your vessels, but I did not owe, I don't owe you any land, right? To borrow land, I guess you plowed or whatever, you know, it's a more difficult thing to borrow. It should be easier to prove if somebody did so. Hodeh b'karkaot v'kafar b'kelim. What about somebody who acknowledges, yes, yes, I used your land, but I didn't actually borrow any of your utensils? Patur. In both cases, that person would be exempt from taking the oath, which contradicts Rav Sheshet's position. Hoda miktzat karkaot patur, miktzat kelim chayav. Or the other view is that somebody who says, I did, in fact, he owes part of the land, then he doesn't have to swear. Miktzat kelim chayav, he would have to take the oath. So what's going on here? And part of the complication is that the treatment of land and the treatment of vessels are fundamentally different here. And the idea is that if you're modeh b'miktzat, if you are admit to part of the claim and you're talking about movable property, then yes, then you have to take an oath. If you're talking about the land, when you're talking about land, you don't have to take an oath to begin with. And why that is, it's going to, you know, take us further afield today. It's something we're going to have to keep in mind to delve into as we go. But the bottom line is that land, to begin with, is not really subject to an oath.
Well, what's confusing here is that actually the Gemara doesn't sort of explicitly explain it. It's actually just a principle that they assume that you know, that, you know, land is not something you take an oath for. So I think that's part of what makes this passage a little bit complicated.
Right, I think so. Like, we're already deep in, don't you already know all of the principles at hand? And the answer is no, we're just getting our feet wet.
Well, that's our DAF discussion for the day. Rinkus Review us on all major podcasts. Thank you to Rabbi Michelle Farber for hosting us on the Hadron website. Let us know what you thought about this DAF on our Talking Talmud Facebook page. And until tomorrow, go and learn.